Today it's volume two of my last conversation with Mark Colvin, who died on May the 11th. Mark Colvin was one of Australia's greatest journalists and foreign correspondents, and he presented PM on ABC Radio for two decades. In the first part of this conversation, Mark talked about growing up as the son of an Australian mother and a British father who was a spy for Britain's Foreign Intelligence Service, MI6. In this conversation with Mark, we followed his life as a journalist in some of the world's most insane places. Mark witnessed revolutions firsthand in Iran and Poland. He saw the massacres in Rwanda, which is where he contracted the rare autoimmune disease called Wegener's granulomatosis. Through all of it, Mark was buoyed up by his ceaseless curiosity, asking the classic questions of journalists, which he says are, where is the money? Who really runs this town? Who benefits from this? What lies behind what you're telling me? And why are you lying to me? Mark Colvin's memoir is called Light and Shadow. Welcome back, Mark.
Thank you very much. Why are you lying to me?
I checked my facts. I'm sure I got it right. I don't know. I confess.
Yeah.
Have you found that asking that question sometimes to a subject that people will blurt out the truth even if it hurts them sometimes?
I don't think I've ever asked straight out, why are you lying to me? But I have. You know, there is a type of interview where you're just really persistent, and why won't you answer the question? And, you know, I've heard you talk about interviewing, and you and I have exactly the same philosophy, I think, which is that you, above all, you listen. You listen, 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 and then when you ask the questions, you go, why, how, and questions that begin with but, you know, but if that's the case, this is particularly in political interviewing, you know, but if that's the case, how is that going to work, or, you know, those kinds of things. But the simple questions are the best.
There is something in people that does need to confess sometimes if you ask the right question. They'll admit to things if they, even that don't paint them in a flattering light, they'll just come out with it. Have you found that?
Yeah, you know, I think everybody of my generation learned that from watching Mike Willacy on This Day Tonight and then on whatever he went to do in the commercials. Mike Willacy, some people might more recently remember him from a few other on-air tribulations. There was a night when he was, the next morning, the management described him as having been a bit rusty. So I quite often go out and get rusty. But
rusty is a newt, I think the phrase is.
Yeah, that's right. The Willacy technique was very much to just sit there, maybe count to three or four after an answer, and then somebody will blurt something out. Slightly harder to do that on radio, but if you've got the guts to do it, you can.
You graduated from Oxford University in 1973, and you were still a young man. You'd lived all over the world. Did you have any clear career path in mind for you when you left Oxford?
It's ridiculous that I didn't, because I'd been steeped in current affairs throughout my childhood, throughout my adolescence. My dad had been in Hanoi, as we talked about yesterday, and in Ulaanbaatar, and I'd been to Ulaanbaatar. I'd been through China during the Cultural Revolution, and I'd never thought, no, I could write about this for a living. I had actually been for a while, because in 1969 in Canberra, I worked at the Australian National University at the Research School of Biological Sciences, developing photographs from an electron micrograph, and I started to take a lot of photographs then. And then my first summer at university, I worked on a little local paper in Cornwall called the Falmouth Packet, which was allied with the Helston Packet and the Camborne and Redruth Packet.
And that great journal we turned to in times of national crisis.
And so I worked as a photographer there. But, you know, you start looking at pictures by Henri Cartier-Bresson, you end up thinking, I'll never do that. I'll never, never, never be able to do that. And also, I was better at writing the captions.
Well, so there you are. All your inclination is leading you one way, and your experience is knocking on the door. And yet, nonetheless, you went, well, I don't know what I'm going to do with my life.
No, I went and worked on building sites and got heat stroke and got sacked repeatedly for being, you know, insufficiently strong and able to cope with the Canberra sun in December.
So there you are in Canberra, not knowing what to do with your life. What did you do? How did you break the logjam and get yourself into journalism?
Well, I went on the dole. I went to the CES, the Commonwealth Employment Service, and sat in a room with lino floors and where the public servants were protected from you by a double sheet of glass, I think, filled in the forms, waited and waited, and was eventually called up and was told, oh, you shouldn't be here. You've got a degree. So I said, well, what do you mean? You should be upstairs at the PES, the Professional Employment Service. So I go up the stairs, and there is this place with lovely blue carpets and sofas and little occasional tables with magazines on them. And somebody comes and sits next to me on the sofa and says, you know, well, what do you want to do with your life? And no, serious. It's true. This was 1973, full employment, where full employment meant full employment.
So you went from the CES to something effectively upstairs to an executive appointment service of the kind.
Exactly like that, yeah. Also, don't forget that there were far fewer universities. There were no journalism schools, zero journalism schools. There were far fewer people with a degree. And also there was some kind of weird cultural cringe thing about a bloke with an Oxford degree walking in. So anyway, come back in 3 days. I go back in 3 days. He's got a folder full of things. There's a few things for the public service, but he thinks that what I'd probably might like to do, because I can write a bit, is try for journalism. I've got 3 applications. One's for the Sydney Morning Herald, one's for the ABC, one's for Channel 7, but local Channel 7 in Canberra. I write off to all of them. And within a week, I'd got an interview at the Canberra Channel 7. And a week later, I'd got invitations to come to Sydney for the Herald and the ABC. And I got offered the job at Channel 7. And I kept that in the back pocket in case I got the job at the ABC or the Herald. I went to the Herald and got lost in Sydney and ended up at Harold Park because my English accent was... I must have said, can I go to the Harold, please?
So you're taking the Harold Park Raceway.
Yep, right. Harold Park Raceway.
Which actually isn't that far from the old Herald building anyway.
Exactly. Fortunately. So I still got to the interview on time, but I failed the interview. You know, apart from anything else, the interview had questions like, if a light aircraft crashed into the harbour bridge, who would you ring first? I hadn't the faintest idea. I'd never lived in Sydney. Although, obviously I picked up on the questions, and by the time I got to the ABC, I knew the answer to that one and a few more.
So you applied for this cadetship at the ABC. You were a pretty stylish young chap in those days, marked by the standards of the early 1970s. What kind of figure did you cut striding into the interview room as the young Mark Colvin?
Well, fashionistas would know the term double denim. Yeah, I had a denim jacket and loon pants.
What are loon pants?
Those extremely wide at the bottom trousers.
Oh, yeah, like bell bottom flares.
Yeah. They were known as loon pants in the 70s. I think I probably had a kipper tie. Yeah, probably a polyester shirt as well. Everybody did in the 70s.
Once you started work in the newsroom, what was the technology like? How did you put together a radio story back then without the internet or with digital editing as we have today?
Well, there's a thing called a telephone that you had to use a fair bit. Rotary dial. There were typewriters. It was a big room at the back, which was double soundproofed, which contained the UPI, Reuters, various wire services coming in, and also the telexes. A telex was a type of machine that printed out material on a long roll of paper. It's odd, isn't it, realizing that you actually have to explain what a telex was, I think, now. So this would be torn off in strips. It would come out and be put in baskets. And then the stuff that was rejected would be actually put on literally a spike.
Oh, there was a spike as such.
A colleague of mine once wrote a story which he was so sure was going to be spiked that he actually typed on top, attention spike. So I've always thought Spike was a bloke, really.
And so you're there in William Street in the ABC building, and you're encouraged to be curious, to go out and find stuff that's actually happening in the world outside. Yet you said it was really obvious that there was plenty of stuff going on right outside the building that was unreportable. What were some of the things that were going on at the time?
Well, I think probably the most spectacular example I can give you is walking up Darlinghurst Road, which was just up the road. I actually saw a pimp walk out of a doorway and handle literally the proverbial large brown envelope stuffed with something through the window of a police car. The police car's just crawling along. Bloke walks out, hands it through the window to the copper.
Why were such things thought to be unreportable in those days?
Partly because of the libel laws and the fact that the ABC had an exceptionally cautious legal department. Partly because we know now that from the memoirs of the son of Abe Saffron. Abe Saffron was Mr. Sin. Was he Mr. Mm-hmm. Sin or Mr. Big? I can never remember.
Lenny McPherson was Mr. Big and
that's right.
Saffron was Mr. Sin.
Abe was Mr. Sin. And we know from his son's memoirs that both the Premier, Robert Askin, and the Police Commissioner, Norm Allen, were taking large sums of money from Abe Saffron. And we know from the entire history of Roger Rogerson, who we can libel freely now that he's in jail. It wouldn't be libel, we're just telling the truth.
Having been found guilty of murder, yes.
And we know also from the Wood Royal Commission in the 90s, that the entire system was rotten to the core. And it was just really difficult to report it. There were people who tried to report it. We tried to report it. A year later, I joined Double J, and we tried really hard to report on what was going on in Victoria Street, which was one of the most notorious aspects of all of that. And that involved the death of a woman called Juanita Nielsen, who was a local journalist, ran a campaigning newspaper up there, and she was almost certainly killed by Saffron. Not by Saffron, but on Saffron's orders. All of that sort of thing was happening, but you would try to get this stuff to air, and you couldn't put it in any way that the lawyers would let it go through.
They eventually, as you say, soon afterwards you were posted to the newsroom of the brand new radio station 2JJ when it was launched in 1975. Just give me a sense of the impact of the arrival of 2JJ in Sydney in that time.
In terms of the radio industry, it was seismic. And in terms of our generation then, I'm talking 18 to 25, 18 to 30, whatever, it was also seismic. It was just an extraordinary thing because a bit like what we were talking about yesterday when I was at school and, suddenly the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Who and Dylan and all the rest of it. A bit like that, Australia had been to some degree insulated or running behind the rest of the world in terms of pop culture, rock culture, whatever. And what had happened was that you had all these commercial stations which only played singles and they only played high-rotation singles. And when they played them, they censored them. John Lennon's Ballad of John and Yoko, Christ, It Ain't Easy, You Know How Hard It Can Be. On 2SM, the Christ was always beeped out because 2SM stands for To St. Mary and it was owned by the Catholic Church.
Yes, that sort of thing. Double J launched with Skyhook's song.
You just like me because I'm good in bed.
Yeah, which was one of the best songs off their Living in the 70s album. But that had no...
Followed by Sympathy for the Devil.
Right. Yeah, for a start, that song was Australian.
Yep.
Secondly, it wasn't getting any airplay. Yep. And thirdly, it was fantastic.
It wasn't getting any airplay because it was bad.
Yes. So that, I suppose, was
on the commercial stations.
That was a very neat statement about 2JJ's purpose at that point, which has since become Triple J. This was, of course, in the lead-up to the turbulence of the Whitlam years, the dismissal crisis. How did that divide the Double J staff at the time, Mark?
Well, I joined a couple of weeks after the station started, and the station was definitely it was there to stir things up. It was there to shake things up. And one of the things that happened was, I think, that there was a division between the people who thought that we should be guided by the ABC Charter in terms of covering things as balanced a fashion as possible, and the people who, during the Senate supply crisis, wanted to have a day of rage, and there was a day of rage, and people were cut off on air for expressing dissent from the pro-Whitlam line. And we had a big fight about this, and it was mainly the newsroom versus the rest. And in a way, it was really lucky that it happened during the supply crisis, because actually what happened was that when the dismissal came, we'd had all the arguments. And so Jim Middleton, Nick Franklin and I and Matt Cocker and Kerry Phillips were able to cover the thing in a way that was respectably within the ABC charter, but still was different from the rest of the media. Everything we were trying to do was trying to cover things in such a way that were that our generation would understand.
Well, the funny thing is, if you listen to the tone of the language that was being used by Double J, now sounds like the normal language of radio anywhere. Yeah. And the language that was being used in mainstream radio just sounds weird.
Yes.
It sounds weird and stuffy and pompous and unnatural and formal.
Yes.
So in that sense, Double J sort of came as the upstart but then colonised the rest of radio.
I think that's true, actually. And you know, the former editor of The Australian, Chris Mitchell, wrote a column a couple of months ago where he said that, you know, the problem with the ABC was, and the problem with the media in general, was that it had been colonised by ex-Double J and Triple J types. I was very hurt that he didn't mention me.
Oh, yes, of course.
Deeply disappointed.
You are one of the long-haired louts he had in mind.
That's
from
right.
back then.
And he did include Tony Jones, who never worked for Double J or Triple J. So it was doubly insulting, really.
You were brought into TV news in 1978, and this took you occasionally to you'd have to interview or be part of the press pack that was covering the new up-and-coming politician, Member of Parliament, Bob Hawke, who entered the Parliament in 1980. You got the feeling, though, that Hawke just didn't like you. How would he express that?
Well, the usual Hawke thing was the eyes would roll up into the head and there was a sort of sneer. But he kind of did that anyway. There was he had this weird habit of the eyes rolling up into the head when he was talking, and I think it was to a degree because he was thinking so hard about what he was saying. But he reserved a particularly, I don't know, subtly sneering attitude.
Like he disdained me. You. He disdained you.
He disdained
you.
Me, yeah. And it wasn't until years later when I was in Brussels and he was coming through and he did exactly the same thing. And I said, you know, Hawke, I've met him a few times. You know, I've interviewed him a few times. I've been in the press pack a lot and asked him questions. And he's always seemed to reserve a special disdain for me. And I don't know why it is. And the answer from the staffer was, mate, he just hates bombs. And I always wonder, I can tell you now, Bob, I'm half Australian by birth. I've got an Australian birth certificate. I just sounded like a pom.
You should have showed up at a press conference wearing one of those Bazza McKenzie pommy bastard t-shirts. Right. That might have broken the ice between you and Hawke.
At the time, yeah.
If only. You went from Nationwide to Four Corners and then was appointed London correspondent for the ABC. You write that just before you were due to leave for the UK, you received news that one of your colleagues at the Bureau had been shot and killed while on assignment in Africa, a journalist by the name of Tony Joyce. This all took place in a military checkpoint, a horrible story. What kind of a pall did that put on the Bureau once you joined up there, Mark?
I'd left the place in absolute grief and mourning. You know, Tony was a really remarkable man, very, very funny, very, very clever, full of, you know, lightning energy, and everybody who knew him, you know, was touched by him in one way or another, and it left a great dark cloud over the place for months and months and months, and it also left the ABC in a situation of not wanting to send anyone anywhere for a long time.
But, of course, you were there to actually report, and you had to go out into the world. And eventually they agreed to send you out to cover the Iranian hostage crisis in Tehran after a bunch of students in Iran, after the Iranian Revolution, had stormed the Iranian embassy and taken all the US diplomatic staff there hostage.
The ABC's Mark Colvin was an eyewitness to one of the day's bloodiest skirmishes.
ABC cameraman Les Seymour and myself had gone to the university in an attempt to find out some of the reasons for the deep-seated hostility between the revolutionary Muslims and the revolutionary left-wingers in the university.
Well, don't you think the rest of the world has a right to be interested in what goes on here?
No!
Sure.
Are you interested in people and human rights?
I agree with you.
Go to southern Lebanon.
This was a huge story at the time. Was there a bit of trepidation about sending you out to such a dangerous place?
Total. Ken Begg, who was the bureau chief at the time, stood on the landing at 54 Portland Place, which was our office at the time, and there were tears running down his face, and he was telling me to take care, and I said, I'll be okay, don't worry. And it wasn't till years later that I discovered that he'd had pretty much exactly the same conversation with Tony Joyce a few months before.
What do you remember as you arrived at the airport and going through the streets of that smog-laden, very exciting city?
The most insane traffic I've ever been in, actually, Tehran. And most people tell me that it's still the same, incredibly scary. I'd been told to hit the ground running, and so we asked the driver what was going on, and I thought that he told me that Ayatollah Khomeini was preaching to the congregation. Turned out to be Ayatollah Khamenei, who is now the Grand Ayatollah and succeeded Khomeini after his death. But just back then, he was just an Ayatollah. And we arrived at this, looked like more like a demonstration than anything else. And up on the stage, Khamenei is there, very stern face, with a Quran in one hand and a Kalashnikov in the other, preaching, and this big crowd. And, you know, we got enough film to be able to put together a story that I could send out on the first day. And, you know, it was quite good too.
How vulnerable were you and your crew as Westerners, who are visibly Westerners, reporting on the scene of such events?
Not vulnerable until later. Until, I mean, there was a certain amount of hostility, but as soon as you said Australian, things would change. And there was this weird kind of flip-flop. There'd be death to America, death to the great Satan, death to the little Satan. So that America is the great Satan, Britain is the little Satan. And then they would come up to you thinking you're American or British, and you'd say you're Australian, and they'd say, oh, you know, how do we get a visa? Or, you know... I'll ask you about kangaroos and koalas, you know. But then later it became very dangerous.
You were staying in the Intercontinental Hotel with all the journalists at the time,
yeah.
The Western journalists who were reporting from Tehran. How present were the morals police in the hotel while you
ever
were there?
Ever present. Daily you'd get a knock on the door. Daily you'd open the door and there's a bloke in a turban and a brown gown and two enormous thugs an enormous thug on either side of him with guns. And they just push past you, turn your bed upside down, turn everything in the room upside down. They're looking for booze. So I was quite inured to the idea of being a teetotaler for a month or however long I was going to be there. But this was outrageous as far as I was concerned. So I managed to get a couple of six-packs of beer on the black market, and I stashed them. I unscrewed the grating of my air conditioning vent and stashed them up there, and then used to take great pleasure, being very careful never to look up at the vent. You'd take great pleasure every day as they ransacked my room, but they never got the beer.
Tell me how you managed to sample real caviar for the first time in your life.
Well, that was the better knock on the door. There'd be a little knock on the door, and you'd open the door, and there was the black market caviar salesman. See, what you've got to realize is that this was a society with absolute rampant inflation. The price of the rial, the currency, was just going through the floor. But there was a black market and there was a white market. And if you changed your money on the black market, you could get enormous numbers of rials. Or you could use your pounds or dollars to buy things for far less than they were actually worth. And the other thing was, the other background to that story is that the Intercon had been cut off from the intercontinental chain, that the Iranians had cut them off. And so it was widely believed among the journalists that we were eating stuff that had been in the fridges for years, and everybody complained of stomach upsets and things. So this bloke turns up, and he's selling me a tin of caviar, a tub of caviar.
A tub
of caviar. And I've never tried it. So I said, oh, I'll have a small one, you know, and just try it. And then I rang down to room service for some blinis and sour cream and slices of lemon. And I discovered that this stuff is amazing, you know, because I'm eating a plate of caviar for about a couple of bucks, you know. It's just like buying a cup of coffee. And so he would turn up every two or three days, and I bought larger and larger tubs. And I think I left with an enormous tub, which I'd paid £15 sterling. And I was told back in London that it was probably worth about £10,000.
Did you sell it?
No.
You ate the lot?
I didn't eat the lot, but I ate and shared the lot. What an idiot.
Oh,
I
don't know.
Flat for it back then.
I don't know. I think I might have done the same, I think. A short while after into your time there, President Jimmy Carter authorized a helicopter rescue of the U.S. hostages, but the rescue attempt failed disastrously, helicopters crashing into one another in the desert. It was an absolute tragedy and a debacle. And this terrible incident, this failed attempt, raised anti-Americanism, anti-Western attitudes in Tehran to a fever pitch. This is when you would have been fearful
exactly
of your safety.
That's exactly right, yeah.
And then you did something quite uncharacteristic. You rang your dad.
Yeah, and Nick Warner, who's the Director General of ACES, launched my book last week, and he mentioned this incident, and even he, who runs Australia's Foreign Intelligence Services now, said that he thought this story was just insane. It was one of the most dangerous things. But I rang my dad, who was still just coming towards the end of his term in Washington, in Kim Philby's old job as the liaison with the CIA, and I just rang him, and we had a long chat about what was going on. He wanted to know what was going on, and I, so again, you know, I'm so naive at this stage, but I knew enough not to ask him straight out. But I did say, you know, I wonder if you're aware at all that this place is just absolutely teeming with rumors that there's going to be a second attempt, that the Americans are going to try again. Because I've been told by people who really know the place that if there's a second attempt, then every Westerner in the place will be strung up. We were really scared, and everybody in the place was pretty scared at that stage. And, you know, I wonder if any of your contacts in Washington might know anything about that. And he told me that it was the most insane thing that he ever did, but he did eventually ring back about 6 or 7 hours later and say, no, that's not going to happen. And so that was a great relief to me. What I don't know is whether he was being fantastically indiscreet. As he maintained, he was being fantastically indiscreet and doing something incredibly dangerous. Was he doing that, or was he actually assuming that this call was being monitored? Was he actually getting a message through me to the Iranian government to let them know that there wasn't another attempt on the way?
That would certainly have to be the case. I would think anyway. Yeah. Given that your phone would almost certainly have been tapped.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
So once again, Colvin is the intermediary of some hugely important bit of intelligence that's being passed from one foreign government to another.
Yeah,
but the unwitting,
quite unaware, yes,
unwitting media.
Yeah, that's William
man.
Boot. You see,
just 2 days later, after that incident, you got word that the regime was going to let some reporters into the embassy compound, the U.S. embassy compound that had been overrun by the students where the hostages were being held. Tell me what happened after you and other journalists were admitted through the gate of the U.S. embassy in Tehran.
Well, the first thing that happened was that we were kept there for about an hour in the broiling heat and humidity and smog. And we're looking around. We're the first people ever back into the U.S. embassy in Tehran since the hostage taking. And so if it was now, you'd get on the phone or text something back to Sydney or whatever. You would file something that said, I am the first, well, I'm among the first journalists back into the embassy. But you couldn't do that. We just had to sit there in the sun. There were guards, revolutionary guards, walking along the rooftops. There were revolutionary guards pointing Kalashnikovs at us on the ground, and there was a podium, and next to the podium there was a big pile of stuff covered in tarpaulins. Didn't know what it was. And then eventually, after about an hour, the Ayatollah Khalkhali arrived, and he was known as the hanging judge because he had invented a system called obvious justice, which meant if he decided you were obviously guilty, then you could be hanged. I think his record was he found guilty, sentenced and executed 60 people in one day in Kurdistan. Charming bloke. He was known as the cat strangler because NBC had interviewed him once, and in an interview that never went to air, or a bit of film that never went to air, they asked him, what would you do if the Shah came back right now? And he picked up the cat from his lap and strangled it to death in front of the camera. Lovely bloke. So we kind of knew, my interpreter's kind of whispering some of these stories in my ear as we wait.
So you've got a fanatic here who's fond of a bit of gruesome theatre, in other words.
A psychopath. Yeah. And he comes out, and then he starts talking, and then the interpreters try to start interpreting, and they're all told to shut up. So we have to wait while he makes a half-hour speech in Farsi, and we don't know what he's saying. And in a way, it's like a silent movie a bit, that you get even more of an impression because of the theatre of what happens next, which is that he turns to one of these burly revolutionary guards, gets them to take the tarp off the pile. They're wooden crates. He opens the crates and starts pulling stuff out of them. And at that stage, you start to smell it. It's the smell of roasted human flesh. But you still don't quite believe what you're seeing until the moment for me when he picked up a piece of, looked like a piece of burnt stick about half a meter long, and started scraping at it with a knife. And you saw as he scraped away an aviator watch, and you realized that he was holding a man's arm, one of the people who'd been burned to death in the desert in Operation Eagle Claw. And so it was, that was really very, very confronting.
Could you file that as a story?
Yes, I did. In fact, Tony Jones, who presents Q&A now, I had dinner with the other night, and he said it was the first radio story that he ever really remembers, because the description of the, particularly the description of the smell, was so graphic. I think he was still a student at the time, and he says he's never forgotten it.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
Where do you go in your mind when that happens? Do you have to distract yourself with something, put your mind into some other place?
Yes, I think there is a mechanism that a lot of journalists use, and I think in journalism you're lucky because you have the writing, the directing of the camera, the structuring of the story, all of that. And so you can have that in one compartment of your mind.
So do you think I'm going to now really concentrate on the pad in front of me while I'm writing this?
No, I tend to write in my head and then type it out later. I tend to have a whole story. Like even writing the book, I tended to have half a chapter in my head.
So that's what you just focused on then in your head when
yeah, you start trying to put it into an order. You start trying to write it and make sense of it, while at the same time another compartment of your brain is being outraged by it.
One thing you show in the book is that this is actually a moment when the Iranian Revolution could have gone either way. It's always tempting to look at history as a series of inevitable events, but of course it's not like that at all. What was the turning point you think you witnessed while you were there?
Well, I think it was Eagle Claw. It was the Americans.
The botched rescue mission.
Yeah, because ever since the Ayatollah came back, and you've got to remember that the Ayatollah Khomeini, when he came back on that famous flight and they told him, ground control is telling us that they will fire rockets at you if you proceed any further, and somebody went to him and said, how do you feel as you approach Iranian soil again, Ayatollah Khomeini? And he just said, nothing. Either during that flight or earlier in Paris, he had absolutely said that he did not want a rule by Ayatollah. He wanted to maintain the separation of mosque and state, if you want to call it that. So then things began to change during that period. The invasion of the embassy itself was one of the big turning points, because that meant that suddenly the extremists and the fundamentalists and the people who did want Ayatollahs to rule had the upper hand. But there was still, on the streets, in the universities, an enormous amount of resistance going on. And what you've got to remember is that the Ayatollah came back not just because fundamentalists wanted him back, but because there were lots of much more secular people who believed this promise that he would come back, that the Shah would be gone, and the excesses of the Shah, you know, it was a torture regime, let's face it, it was a dictatorship, and that would be gone. And so he had huge support from students in the first couple of months of the regime, and then that started to fade away, and that started to turn into resistance, both secular and Marxist and fundamentalist Islamic from another point of view, the Mujahideen, the Fadayeen. But Iran is still, even more so now, full of people who watch American television on their satellite dishes and read Western literature and want a secular democracy. What I witnessed there for the first 3 or 4 weeks was a civil war. There was a civil war going on in Tehran.
The Iranian Islamic clergy appear to be aiming for a head-on clash with the country's left-wing groups. They've chosen the universities as the field of battle. Among the most prominent of the political groups on campus are the Mujahideen and Fadayeen, left-wing Islamic organizations who claim to have played a significant part in the success of last year's revolution. Meanwhile, this new political row is diverting attention from Iran's drastically worsening economic situation.
There were bombs going off in the street, there were massive riots, there were fights between Hezbollah and Mujahideen, all of that stuff was going on. And then I did an interview with one of them who said, look, there is another, a second revolution coming. And that was about 2 days before the Americans invaded.
And that was that. That everyone, the country rallied behind the Ayatollah.
Absolutely. And you've got to also realize that this runs very deep in Iran because they did lose a democratic president in 1953. Mossadegh was brutally deposed by the CIA. One of the interesting things, which is unstated in the book, but you can work it out for yourself, is that my dad's career pretty much ends in 1980. He certainly leaves the MI6. He retires from MI6 in 1980. He goes on doing stuff that is a bit spooky. And then my career as a foreign correspondent begins in 1980. And so part of the story is him fighting the Cold War and me covering the end of the Cold War, the last decade of the Cold War. But also, right there in the middle, is this event in 1980 surrounding 1979, the entire Iranian Revolution and all of that. What now is consuming us all, which is the war between Shia and Sunni and the various roles of Russia and America and the Middle East and all of that, that really has its beginning in 1979, 1980.
This is another hinge of history you were taken to report on, which was Poland in 1981, the point when the Solidarity Trade Union had taken on the might of Polish communism. And there was this really interesting moment here. The communist state in Poland was rocked by the rise of this trade union.
I had a great time in Poland. It was an extraordinary time to be there. It was just a time of absolute intellectual ferment, apart from anything else. Again, Wałęsa was Catholic, and one of the reasons why it started to succeed. It got put down, but then it was really the beginning of the end of the Cold War. You had a Polish Pope, and that made a big difference, I think. But just even in Warsaw, there was an absolute ferment going on. And then we drove to Gdansk, which is a beautiful city. Anybody should go there, I think. It's been extraordinarily well reconstructed after the war. And we went to Gdansk, which was the home of the Gdansk shipyards.
Tell me about the interview you undertook, Mark, with the leader of Solidarity at the time, who would later become Poland's president, Lech Wałęsa.
I was really looking forward to doing this interview, and I brought a very good translator, but Wałęsa insisted on using his own translator. And a few years before, Jimmy Carter had been there to Poland and had given a speech and been the victim of a terrible mistranslation in which he said, I want to embrace the Polish people or something like that. But it was translated mistakenly as I want to have sexual relations with the Polish people. The same thing happened to me. The interview's chugging along. It's only just got started. I've just got enough for a quick news story. But, you know, I'm just thinking, let's get a little deeper here. Now, General Jaruzelski was the new leader of the government, and he'd been put in to try and reimpose some order. And he seemed, by Eastern Bloc standards, to be slightly less of a martinet and a dictator. So I said, do you have any respect for General Jaruzelski? And again, the translator said, basically, do you fancy General Jaruzelski? And so Wałęsa says, no, I'm not that kind of man. And I say, because I'm getting the wrong translation back too, and I say, what do you mean? He said, well, I'm just not that kind of man. And basically, from then on, you know, there's three or four more questions, and they're all monosyllabic answers. It's quite a macho culture, and I just basically accused him of being something he didn't want to be accused of at all.
You went to Russia to report at one stage, and you were really nervous or apprehensive about going to Russia.
Yeah, my dad had always told me not to go to Russia.
Why?
Because of his job. And he would never tell me the exact details, but on the way from London to Ulaanbaatar, he went through Moscow and stayed with the British ambassador, and I know that he was followed around and his baggage was interfered with and various... He said there were dirty tricks and there was stuff. They'd got it in for him one way or another, and he was worried that the same thing would happen to me.
Would you be fitted up with something, you think, or
yes,
possibly?
Yeah,
was his worry?
Yeah. But as it turned out, it was just an incredibly difficult shoot, and they became more and more suspicious that we were breaching the conditions on which we were there. Unfortunately, we had a translator, an Australian translator, who was a friend of the head of television news, who had a lot of friends in Moscow, and she, I didn't know this, but she was going out every night and visiting her friends. And she was not spying. She was not doing intelligence tests, but she just absolutely adored... She had lived in Moscow before. She adored Moscow, and she went to all-night parties in little flats, you know, like in that film, The Lives of Others. That was what those places looked like.
Artists and writers who were on the edge of dissidence, right.
Flats, just floor to ceiling with books and desperate to get any news they could about the West. I went to a couple of these places myself. But she was going out in the middle of the night, and they became quite convinced. So it was like ploughing into quicksand as we went on. The trip got more and more and more difficult. And then it ended as we were leaving with the plane being held up on the runway and me being taken aside while the crew had already got on and being told that the plane would be held up as long as necessary and might not take off at all unless I handed over my briefcase. And I was stuck in this room, and I had no way to contact anyone. And I, you know, I still feel terrible about doing this, about the humiliation and unpleasantness of what happened, because they took away my briefcase, which contained my Filofax. That was a thing that we used to have before we had personal organizers and iPhones. So that's all my contacts, all my notes, everything. It had nothing in it that was even remotely compromising, but they took it away long enough to photocopy everything in my briefcase, then came back and sort of curtly told me I could get back on the plane. And, you know, in the meantime, I'd been taken out to lunch by a TASS correspondent who was obviously KGB and pumped, you know, unsuccessfully.
Did anyone mention your father to you while you were there?
No. They're too subtle for that.
Yeah, they would have known, though, wouldn't they?
Yeah, of course. I mean, in retrospect, I think so. And even at the time, I probably thought so. But I was in this rather difficult bind where the ABC... I was the new Europe correspondent, and the ABC had been trying for ages to get in, and finally they'd got a visa. And if I didn't go, no one would go. And so it would have been a sort of dereliction of duty not to go. And Dad tried to dissuade me, but I had to go, really, because there was no way to say... this was still 1984, way before he was outed as a spy. So there was no way to go to say to the ABC, look, I can't go to Moscow because my father works for MI6.
She can't get food.
Nor the tent, nor the blanket.
Well, who is getting it? The strong young men, is that right?
Yes.
I first covered an African famine 15 years ago, and since then I've seen quite a lot of death and disease, but I have never seen anything like the road we've just travelled. I've heard it said that this crisis has now reached rock bottom.
It was as when you were working as a Four Corners reporter in Rwanda that you were hit with that freakish medical accident, a virus that triggered a rare autoimmune reaction. We've talked about this in the past on this program. The virus nearly killed you. It destroyed your hips, part of your leg, I think, and your kidneys until you recently got a transplant.
2013, yeah.
Living on dialysis, as you had to for all that time, you write that changed the way you interact with the news of the world in a kind of Arthur Conan Doyle sort of way. Can you explain what you mean by that?
I remember, I think I was 12 or 13 one summer holidays. The only book in the house was The Complete Works of Arthur Conan Doyle. Damn good book to have for your summer holidays when you're 12 or 13. So I read the lot, you know. And I picked up very early. I was always aware of the forgotten brother, Mycroft, who sits sometimes in the window of the Diogenes Club, and he never goes anywhere. But when Sherlock can't work stuff out by his usual processes, he goes to Mycroft, and Mycroft is Sherlock Holmes' smarter brother. Was there a film called that? Mm-hmm. Something like that. So when I became too ill to really get around much. I was going from the Sherlock mode, which is going out and hunting. I suppose when I joined PM, really, you have to become the Mycroft. You have to become the one who gets other people to come to you and tell them the story. And that's what I try to do on PM, is to talk to the correspondents, talk to the foreign correspondents. I work with a lot of people in Sydney, you know, trying to help them tell their stories better and all of that. But above all, I suppose you become this person who wants to live vicariously. Mark Willacy, when he was in Fukushima, when he was Tokyo correspondent, you know, we talked a lot on and off air, but I want to kind of be there. And by being there, put the listener there. That's been my technique a lot, I think.
Turns out it wasn't so bad being Mycroft, though, rather than Sherlock. And you use Twitter brilliantly to follow news stories by triangulating from different news stories. And I know what you mean. I did this during the recent coup attempt in Turkey.
Yeah.
Some reports turned out to be erroneous that the Taksim Square was being bombed and it wasn't. Yep. And then you go, oh, no, I saw this from the rooftop and it wasn't like that. And you get Twitter reports from different directions and you get a very 3D view of the news.
Absolutely,
don't you?
And in 2009, which is when I first got onto Twitter, I just got good enough at it. When the Green Revolution started, you know, the revolt against the rigged election, and I was doing exactly that.
In Iran, yes.
In Iran, yes. I'd been in Iran in 1980, and in 2009, 29, nearly 30 years later, I was kind of back there in a virtual sense, trying to reconstruct stories off the street, and sometimes literally taking people's Twitter timelines and getting a voice and turning them into a story.
Given that you have had your Sherlock years out in the world, seeing things up close, does that help you see events as they unfold now? And do you draw upon things you've seen in the past out in the world?
Very much so. Absolutely. In microcosm, yes, because you actually, when you talk to a correspondent, you will literally say, what does it smell like? Or give me the other senses other than just your eyes. But also in macrocosm, take the wider view, the idea that, and I believe this so strongly, the idea that what happens on the ground is never what you think it's going to be. The idea that reporting, rather than re-reporting, constantly recycling what's already been reported or commenting on what's already been reported, is so important. There's a great film called Rashomon, which tells one story from seven completely different points of view, and they all tell a different story, and you have to put it together yourself. The more reporters there are on the ground, and I come from the golden age when you could read a dozen stories about a particular event and try and make up your own mind, and now there seems to be quite often only one or two original accounts of something. And I think the more pairs of eyes there are on any story, the more truth you get out of it.
I remember being at some event with you once and during the Arab Spring, and there was a lot of optimism and hope. And I think you talked about
it. I wrote a column about that.
Yeah.
Saying, you know, don't be hasty about this one.
Wait and see.
Wait and see. And it's not only what you've seen on the ground, and in that case, it was very much informed by what I'd seen in Iran, that when things are really in turmoil, the people who are most ruthless are usually the ones who are most likely to win. But also through the study of history, I mean, the study of the French Revolution, in which, you know, the whole thing gets eaten up, and then Danton gets killed off by Robespierre, and then Robespierre himself gets killed off. Same thing happened in Iran. You know, most of the people who were considered fundamentalists and really quite far to one side when I was there in 1980 are now either dead or in exile. The ruthlessness gets worse. Oh, yeah, I think history and experience teach you things there.
Having seen a lot of the ugly way in which realpolitik is practiced on the ground and in the upper levels of government, what's kept you from becoming cynical?
Am I not cynical?
I don't think you are. In fact, I know you're not cynical. I know you're not.
I think
you might be pessimistic at times, but that's not the same thing.
I'm certainly extremely sceptical, and I'm very conscious of the difference between those things. I'm getting a bit cynical about politics now. I think it's getting increasingly difficult to hold your convictions without being abused or pushed or And it's not just because we've had a series of precarious governments in Australia where leaders have been pushed by one wing or another of their own parties. It's happening all over the world. It's becoming more and more difficult to hold what you might call a reasonable, logical set of values and ideas because there is so much shouting out there, there's so much extremism out there. I'm getting a bit cynical about that. I'm getting a bit pessimistic about the future of democracy. On occasions, I have days when I really worry about it.
And yet, you seem to be enjoying yourself still, though. You've had this awful health problems that you haven't let define you or really talked about all that much, actually. Nonetheless, there's a very joyful side to you, Mark, I think, isn't there?
Yeah, look, did we talk yesterday about comedy records? If I had another life and another set of talents, I'd have liked to do what you did earlier in your career. I'd like to have been a comedian, or I'd love to have sat in that writer's room with Woody Allen and Mel Brooks, writing for Sid Caesar, or sat in the writer's room for, work with Seinfeld or those people. I mean, I wish I was funny like that, but I do like comedy, and comedy is one of the things that keeps me going. Books, music, all of that. And I went to prison for 5 years between the ages of 7 and 13, I think of it that way. And so you have to become resilient to survive that. And then, I have this weird little mind flip where I sometimes say the word prison when I mean the word hospital, because I've spent such long periods in hospitals and they feel like prisons, My doctor told me at one stage in 95, when I'd had 4 months in hospital and got through the period when I really could have died, because I was hemorrhaging so much. And I said, what about the mental side of it? What about the side of it that gets you through just because you are that particular person? And he said, absolutely. I have seen patients give up in situations just like yours. And when they gave up, they died. I somehow don't have it in me to give up. There's too much that's interesting going on.
You said it's never occurred to you.
No.
It's never occurred to you to do that.
No. No, certainly never occurred to me to give up. Never occurred to me I was going to die, but it never occurred to me to give up. No, absolutely. It's not about even thinking about that. There's too much to read, too much to think about, too many people to talk to, new friends to make. I know people in my age who still have all their old friends but haven't made any new friends for years. I'm not that person. I've made lots of friends. Funnily enough, I've made quite a few friends through Twitter who have become very dear to me,
And you would have been a comedian, but you never had the Latin.
That's exactly.
Mark Colvin, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you the last 2 days. I've so enjoyed it. It's been such a pleasure, Mark. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
On air, online, and on the ABC Radio app. You are listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
Mark Colvin's book is called Light and Shadow, Memoirs of a Spy's Son. That was part two of the conversation I had with Mark in November 2016. And you can listen to part one on our website or get the podcast, abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.